As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleague from The Athletic, Stuart Mandel. It is Sunday morning as we're taping this. Stu, it was a fascinating Saturday of games. One thing I want to really jump into is it felt like for much of the last decade that there was a real clear separation between these like five teams that have gotten very comfortable being in the playoff almost, you know, every year, almost like that. And now they all look pretty vulnerable, do they not?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I would say it's been the whole decade, but certainly for the last 4 or 5 years, there's been, I feel like, that separation. And 3 weeks in, I feel like everybody's beatable. And it's what has been the number one complaint from college football fans: it's gotten too boring. It's the same teams every year. Well, we watched Ohio State lose to Oregon last week. I would say they didn't look so great against Tulsa either. Oklahoma's got issues. Clemson's got issues. And Alabama, I'm not going to hit the panic button just yet, but after the Miami game, everybody's like, oh my gosh, they're going to dominate everybody again all year. And obviously Florida unexpectedly took them right down to the wire. So there's a stat from Adam Rittenberg at ESPN.com late Saturday night. 19 top 25, AP top 25 teams have lost through 3 weeks. That is a record. So even more than the crazy 2007 season. So it does feel like, even though, you know, we haven't had a equivalent of Stanford beating USC that year, certainly, it's mostly been a lot of scares for the top teams, the field could be a little more wide open than it's been in some time.
Yeah, I mean, let's get into the Florida Alabama game for a second. I picked Florida to keep it close. You know, it was a big spread. It was 15 points, and obviously it was a home game for the Gators, and I think that was going to be a charged atmosphere. I also thought there is something to be said for a team that doesn't really fear the aura of Alabama. And I feel like you have that with Florida. In some ways they've looked their best probably in losses against Alabama. You know, like I would make the case, they came into the game ranked number 11. And unlike say Ohio State or even Clemson, you know, and I'm more of a creature of reactionary stuff to what happens in the, you know, when it comes to ranking teams than probably most people are. But like, I think Florida should move up from that 11 spot. Whereas I'm looking at it saying they are much more justified to be higher up than what I've seen from Clemson and Ohio State. Certainly. I mean, I was very impressed by how they went toe to toe with them. They, you know, Alabama does not run the ball very well yet, you know, and it's got two elite linemen. That's two, but you do have to replace new O-line coach. And obviously Bill O'Brien, new coordinator, As good as Bryce Young has been, and they jumped out, I think he had three touchdown passes in the first quarter. You know, it's the no one was going to say this was a great Florida defense. That was a really bad Florida defense last year, and they played really hard and they got a lot of pressure. And I thought it was a really interesting matchup. And I don't know if it's a one-off, but to me, Florida felt like it didn't feel all that fluky.
I want to take it. I mean, it's easy to get into the Alabama part of this, and we will. But I want to take a second and give a shout out to Dan Mullen. You and I both have shown a lot of respect for him. Certainly, when we do our top 25 coaches lists, I feel like he's kind of a divisive guy, and a lot of people just don't buy it. If you look at his Mississippi State record without any context, right, it wasn't that great. I would argue it's very good for Mississippi State, but that's another story. If there's one thing I don't think you can dispute, is how great an offensive coach he is. And to that point, I thought they were going to take a big step back, because when you look to last season, how much of it was that combo of Kyle Trask, Kyle Pitts, Kadarius Toney, and they're all gone. Well, what does Dan Mullen do? He plays to his strengths. Last year, Florida was very much about the pass. Florida ranked 96th in the country in rushing offense last year. Right now, they're number two. And that's despite having just played Alabama. Emory Jones is not a guy who is necessarily going to wow you with his arm, but he can run. And basically, it just seemed like, especially in the second half, they just ran it down Alabama's throat. And in part because you have to deal with a true dual threat quarterback in Emory Jones. Malik Davis looked good as well. Naquan Wright looked good. But yeah, Alabama couldn't stop him. Now, I watched Nick Saban's press conference afterward, and it was not a situation where he got on there and was blasting everybody and seemed really concerned. He just seemed mostly relieved that they got out of there with a win, and he just kept talking about what a tough environment that was for Bryce Young to go into. And if you watch the game, it was very loud. And sometimes I think home field advantage is a little bit overstated, or certainly the crowd noise part of it. Maybe it's more the disruption to your routine. But there were several points in that game when they got penalties, specifically because of the crowd noise, including at the 1 yard line one time. I thought of this late last night. I wanted to suggest it to you. We saw Alabama last year have one of the all-time great dominant seasons, despite COVID, which disrupted a lot of people's seasons. I wonder if there's one aspect of it that played to their advantage, Bruce. They never had to play in front of 100,000 people. They never had to go into an atmosphere like the one they did yesterday. Nobody did. It was pretty interesting to watch that crowd have a direct impact on their ability to do what they want to do on offense.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was a home field advantage. I also thought that Florida looked like, I don't want to say the better conditioned team, but I mean, I don't want to say it, but that's kind of how it felt. It almost looked like Alabama was just didn't have as much juice as Florida did. And I'm sure some of that was feeding off the home crowd. I think, you know, everyone talked about how sweltering and hot it is. It's not like it doesn't get that way in Tuscaloosa, certainly in the summer. So it was a really good game. I mean, I think one thing, and you and I do this a lot and we know it, is you got to caution yourself on reading probably too much into it, you know, but you know, you are judged by your big games. And I thought that was a heavyweight fight. And there was something, you know, like I said, I'd almost like to, you know, kind of pivot a little bit to some of the other teams where, I don't know.
Can I throw one more thing about you related to Alabama? Sure. I remember in the offseason you thought I was too high on Ole Miss and Lane Kiffin. They basically picked their score against Tulane. They got the 61 points mid-third
quarter. We're going to Ole Miss Tulane right now? We're jumping.
Well, here's why. Okay. Matt Corral is the fifth-ranked passer in the country. Ole Miss plays Alabama in 2 weeks. Given what you've seen from those two teams, how much of a shot do you give the Rebels to pull it off?
I give them a shot. I don't – like, I'm going to pump the brakes a little on Ole Miss. I mean, you know, they beat Tulane. Tulane's better under Willie Fritz.
Oklahoma had troubles with Tulane.
Yeah, Stu, I would pump the brakes on it a little. Oklahoma, by the way, you know, had a lot of trouble with Nebraska, too. So I think that may be more of an Oklahoma thing right now. I mean, that's kind of maybe the segue into these other, you know, the Clemson, Oklahoma, Ohio states where it's like, ooh, these teams are right now not what they used to be. But
well, let's talk about it because, okay, Alabama looked vulnerable, but at the end of the day, they went on the road and beat the number 11 team in the country. Oklahoma was playing a Nebraska team that has looked just awful for the most part, certainly coming into this season and against Illinois. Clemson was playing Georgia Tech, who lost to NIU, a team that Michigan just beat the drums off of yesterday, and scored 14 points. Like, there's some major brand name programs out there that I would be hitting the panic button on.
Who would you be the most, if you were a fan of the teams, those, let's say it's those three teams, who would you be the most worried if you were? Like Clemson plays the worst, plays the weakest in the weakest conference by far.
Yeah, and it's easy to say, okay, well, they'll be fine in ACC play, but Georgia Tech is probably one of the worst teams they'll play in there. I mean, I would probably panic the most if I'm an Oklahoma fan. Because
they're the one that actually hasn't lost a game yet.
They haven't lost a game, but you know, like you just dumped on Tulane. Nebraska hasn't been. I mean, how on earth does Oklahoma end up in a one score game against that? I don't care if it's game of the century. Maybe Nebraska got more into the rivalries. We talked in the offseason about Spencer Rattler and he's being talked about as the number one pick. And we're like, well, he's played one season. I wouldn't necessarily say he had his moments. I wouldn't say it was the most amazing season. And now all of a sudden it's just like, felt like we skipped over a period in his career straight to number one pick. And yeah, needless to say, he's not looked like a number one pick. He certainly didn't against Nebraska. Now, he wasn't, you know, throwing interceptions. He wasn't having a Michael Penix type disaster game by any means, but it didn't look like a Lincoln Riley Oklahoma offense. It was very conservative and he wasn't really trying to throw downfield. I feel, I don't know if, of course you can never tell, like how much of that is him, how much of that is we've just come to expect that Oklahoma will always have a D.D. Westbrook, a C.D. Lamb, a Marquise Brown type receiver, and maybe they don't have that right now. And they just look very disjointed.
Yeah, I think they just haven't looked that crisp and they haven't hit as many of those plays that we expect. Everything I've heard is they have a lot of confidence in the skill guys they have, but they've looked a little off. Now, it's good for them because they looked a little off and they're still undefeated. But no doubt, it's just, it's different. I mean, when you look at them, this is interesting. You know, Oklahoma, which has been a big play group as much as anybody, they are tied for second to last in the Big 12 in plays of 30 yards or longer. You know, like that, just going back, that metric, you have to find, you have to go back to before Lincoln Riley was the head coach to see when they're not ranked in the top two. And they're almost every year the number one team in the Big 12 in that. So the big play has not been there the way so far. And I don't know. Like, as I look at these three teams, the team that I feel like right now is the shakiest is Ohio State. They really looked... you know, first of all, their pass rush has not been what it almost always is. It's been really listless. Ryan Day changed basically. Yeah, Kerry Coombs is the defensive coordinator, but now Matt Barnes who is a secondary coach and a former special teams guy. Now he is the play caller, basically running the defense, and that's a significant change. Matt Barnes, by the way, he was not the defense coordinator in name the year that DJ Durkin was. It was basically shelved when the Jordan McNair tragedy happened. I remember like Matt Barnes was actually the guy running the defense for Maryland then. And he actually did a pretty good job on it. But, man, their linebackers have looked really bad the last couple of weeks. And, again, it's not like Tulsa has been, you know, it's not like Tulsa's UCF or Cincinnati. And they were hanging with them. And really it took Travion Henderson to have an all-time game, rush for almost 300 yards, a freshman running back there, because CJ Stroud did not have a great game either. And I feel like a little bit, I'm not saying this is like a like how Texas used, you know, was under Sam Ellinger, but I do feel like Ohio State is kind of tilted into one of those programs where it's like, our offense is so good, we're going to just have to lean on it. And that's a lot of pressure to put on and basically a true freshman quarterback, no matter how good his running back and wide receivers are, because the defense right now is so shaky. And to me, like, of the three teams we're talking about, we've already said we think the ACC is dreadful right now. And the Big 12, I think, is a little better than that. But if you look at the Big 10 right now, I feel like Iowa, like I thought they were going to be very good, but I feel like Iowa looks like they're going to be a tough out. I feel like Michigan right now, their offense has got an identity and they have been very impressive. I get it. They haven't played great competition, but if you watch them, you're like, they look actually pretty good. And Penn State, I think, can build off of that win over Auburn. And I think Penn State is good. Now, I'm not going to say, you know, Maryland's 3-0, but you know, they have, you know, the 3-0 against almost nobody, but I don't think they looked as sharp as Michigan does. So you, I feel like, were very confident about Ohio State coming out of there. Do you feel like they lose another game before in the regular season?
Right now I do, yeah. And really, my perception of that division has changed considerably. I mean, going into the season, I felt like, you know, we both talked about the defense could be shaky. And I think I said to you on this podcast, well, okay, let's say Ohio State takes a step back. Who in that division would actually rise up and take their place? And we couldn't name anybody. But Penn State's had two big wins so far. I thought what stood out to me about the Auburn game is, yes, they played great defense for the most part. Tank Bigsby got his yards, but they kept them out of the end zone a lot. But Sean Clifford is the guy who's had the question marks hovering over him for 3 years, and he had a great game. But the one that in Michigan, like you said, is just running the ball down people's throats. They're not even trying to pass because they haven't had to. Certainly they will play somebody at some point when they do. But it's been a pretty remarkable transformation from last season. The one that really is impressing me is Michigan State. Didn't have very many expectations for them. I thought Mel Tucker, this is still a rebuilding job. But you talk about a transfer having a big impact. Kenneth Walker, the Wake Forest transfer running back, has come in there and, you know, right out of the gate went for 250, I can't remember the exact number of yards against Northwestern. He had another huge game yesterday against Miami. He's leading the country at 164 yards per game. Peyton Thorne, it's been ages since Michigan State had a quarterback that you really respected, certainly going back to like the last, maybe, I don't know. Would you feel comfortable saying Peyton Thorne already looks like the most competent Michigan State quarterback probably since Connor Cook's last season was there?
You know, Brian Lewerke had some good games early in his career, like not his last year, but in his junior, like in a soft, like he was pretty good. So I don't want to completely act like, you know, it was awful then. You know, he was pretty good early in his career. He was definitely capable, and I thought the receivers were good. Remember, I think you're forgetting that, yes, they were really good on defense, but those were pretty good teams Michigan State had.
Oh, for sure, but it was always, well, they went to the playoff in 2015. After that, they didn't strike fear in you by any means, and they certainly went from kind of being right there with Ohio State for a few years, beating them, 2 out of 3 years, I want to say, to getting blown out by them. And because the program regressed so much under the last few years of D'Antonio, yeah, I didn't think Mel Tucker could have this kind of impact this quick. Now, you could say Miami's a disaster and whatnot. Northwestern has certainly gone from top 10 team last season to falling behind 24-0 at Duke. But yeah, I just think that's an interesting transformation. I don't know that any of those teams I'm ready to say, you know, Michigan State, Big Ten East champ, Penn State, Big Ten East. I'm not ready to do that yet. But to your question, yeah, I think it's going to be very hard for Ohio State or anyone to beat all of the other teams that we're talking about. And like you said, Maryland is a factor as well.
Look, Iowa, Rutgers, Penn State Rutgers
has to
might,
play at Iowa.
Rutgers might be a factor. They have to play that. I'm not the, that place has been a nasty place to play, but that's a road game. Like Shiano's like got them believing again. Like I feel like, and I'm not saying that I think Rutgers or Maryland are going to be top 10 teams. They are much improved. And by the way, Rutgers has, we had Joshua Perry on right before the season. We talked about, they have some playmakers, like their skill guys are actually pretty good. If you watch them.
Yeah. Well, Ohio State's next four games are Akron, Rutgers, Maryland, and Indiana. So the good news is they've got some time. I feel like they've got time to, like, those are teams they can probably just outscore. They've got time to try to get this defense figured out before.
If they play Rutgers on the road like they played Tulsa yesterday, they will lose.
Bold statement, but probably
it's not really. I mean, I watched that game. It was like, yeah, I know what the final score looked like. It wasn't like that for, like, you know, the three quarters plus, you know.
The only reason Rutgers, I'm willing to give Ohio State a little bit of a pass for that performance yesterday, is you're coming off the Oregon loss. You're probably going to have a bit of a letdown. And also, and this was very weird, but Ohio State, which usually sells out the Horseshoe every week, had its lowest attendance since 1971, 76,000 people. That's a lot of empty seats at the Horseshoe. I don't think it was all people just jumping off the bandwagon. I think, I really don't blame anybody if they don't feel comfortable going to a big stadium right now, but it was like, you know, to go from the atmosphere they had the week before to that, I could see why you might sleepwalk a little bit. Now, let's not overlook, like you said, Trayvon Henderson, their freshman running back, breaks Archie Griffin's 49-year freshman rushing record. You know, that's a very encouraging sign. But yeah, the defense is a mess right now. You know, like I said, you're right. They can't just like show up and roll out the ball at Rutgers or against Maryland. But if they can survive those, the important game, the most important games are going to be Penn State on October 30th, and then back to back at the end, Michigan State and Michigan. So they've got time to get better.
Before we go leave the Big Ten, what percent chance would you have that this is the year Jim Harbaugh beats Ohio State? Give me the number.
I want so badly to believe in that, and I will always have the memory of 62-39. I truly thought Michigan was the better team that year, and then you saw what happened. So what percentage chance right now? I think I'll probably keep it pretty low, like 20. What about you?
I would say 35%.
Okay, so neither of us are quite going there yet.
No, and I would have said it was like 15 the beginning of the year, and now it's 35%.
I'd like to see Michigan play one of those better teams in the Big Ten so we can get more of a read on it. But, you know, I think the Washington game didn't turn out to be quite the measuring stick you would have hoped. They clearly have problems. But, you know, to go from – I had this in final thoughts. They – have run for more games, or sorry, rushed for more yards through three games than they did in the whole six game season last year. They are just pounding the ball. So these teams are all concerning, and we haven't mentioned Clemson yet. And frankly, Clemson's offense is a tire fire right now. Georgia, you want to excuse that on Georgia's dominant defense, okay, but Georgia Tech is not good. The final score was 14-8. Credit to Brent Venables' defense. They have yet to give up a touchdown in three games. Georgia Tech did get down there inside the 5-yard line with a chance to possibly maybe tie the game. And James Skalski snuffed out the shovel pass. By the way, there were a lot of bad shovel passes for whatever reason during college football on Saturday. But how is DJ Uiagalelei, who had, you know, set the Notre Dame, I think he set the record last year for most yards by opposing quarterback at Notre Dame Stadium. Three games, he's yet to reach 200 passing yards. Their offense is just a total mess. And you may say, okay, they don't play anybody in the ACC. Well, they're going to play Wake Forest, who blew out Florida State. They're going to play, Louisville had a decent win against UCF. None of these teams are great, but I don't know that they're any worse than Georgia Tech.
So the biggest thing that jumps out at me is Clemson is dead last in the ACC, which is not a great offensive league by any stretch either. Dead last in the ACC in yards per play and total yards. That's staggering, especially when, they played Georgia. They also played an FCS team in there. So
that's amazing.
You know, just to be there with the skill talent. I mean, the receivers they have. Now, the offensive line has been a big concern, and it just feels like they have – right now, I don't know what the identity of Clemson is on offense. And I think, again, they're in a league that is so mediocre right now that they could skate by. I just, you know, when I, again, I don't do a top 10 ranking anymore, but I was just like, would you put them in the top 10 based on what you've watched from them?
No, I don't. I mean, they already have a loss and they look terrible in the game yesterday. If you have them in the top 10, you're still hanging on.
You're not paying it. You're not watching.
Hanging on to your preseason expectations of them. I didn't have Florida anywhere near the top 10. I'd have them in there now. You just have to kind of react to
what you see.
What you're seeing. Their offensive line must just be a complete mess because they're not, when I think of the, when I think of the Deshaun Watson, Trevor Lawrence, Clemson offense, they take shots. They go, our receivers are better than your DBs. We're going to just throw up these 50-50 balls, and we're going to come up with them more than 50% of the time. They're not even trying to do that, despite the fact that DJ has a great arm. It's Dabo referred to them as a work in progress. Well, that work in progress is going to play at NC State this week. NC State obviously didn't look great against Mississippi State, but they're probably still one of the better teams in the conference. So, I don't think this will be another season where you just don't even bother to pay attention to Clemson because they're just going to beat every ACC team by 40. Right now, it's a bit of an adventure. So,
looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Stu, obviously the biggest game of the night after the game in the afternoon with Florida and Alabama was in Happy Valley. It was the whiteout atmosphere. Auburn visited, and just sitting in our green room, like, that game felt different than all the other games. Just the energy in there, even to some degree compared to the Florida one, I felt like just, and again, maybe it was because of the night atmosphere, because of the whiteout, something about it. I thought Auburn's defense actually played really, really well. I mean, it was hard for Noah Cain and some good running backs to get anything going. But it's a big win for the Big Ten as much as anything. I mean, what was your takeaway from watching that Penn State team, which already now has two really good wins, by the way, in the first 3 weeks of the season?
Yeah, I mean, an incredible scene. And then afterward, Holly Rowe is interviewing James Franklin and Sean Clifford, and they're fired up. They had this big win, and it's almost like last year, 2020, never happened. It's hard to believe it was just last season that they started 0-5. And we knew there were a lot of weird circumstances that went into it. But you can't ask for a better way to just kick that to the curb by beating Wisconsin and Auburn two of the first 3 weeks of the season. We haven't seen the new AP poll yet. I have to think they're solidly in the top 10 at this point. And
they should be in the top 5 at this point, I think.
Part of the CFP conversation. The defense has been terrific. In both games, Tank Bigsby had, I think, over 100 yards. But, Bo Nix, and I feel like this is the story of his whole career, struggled mightily in that atmosphere. But I think the thing I'd be most encouraged about is Sean Clifford, who had a miserable season last year. He only had 4 incompletions the entire night. It just seemed like anytime they needed a big play, he would find Jahan Dotson or one of the tight ends.
Yeah.
Why Penn State always has a great tight end, bigger, great pass catching tight end. So, yeah, it was a really big win for them. I wrote about this in my final thoughts column. Towards the end, Kirk Herbstreit went on a little bit of a soliloquy about how this had been such a great week and such a great atmosphere, and specifically because it was the Big Ten versus the SEC. And when you think about it, you know, Auburn had just entered the top 25 the week before. This wasn't a Ohio State Oregon type game where you've seen it coming all offseason. It felt as big as it did because Auburn's in the SEC. And anytime you can beat an SEC team, it's a measuring stick game. And so I'm thinking about that going, yeah, he said, I hope we have more of these in the future. And I was like, I agree. The more Big Ten SEC I can get, the better. And then it's like, huh, how come the Big Ten wants to be part of this alliance where, if anything, you know, they're not saying they can't schedule the SEC, but are you really going to if you're already going to play one ACC and one Pac-12 team every year? There are some great home and homes already scheduled, especially Ohio State, Alabama, and Ohio State, Georgia. So we have that to look forward to. But George Kliavkoff, the Pac-12 commissioner, has been going out there preaching the gospel of the alliance to anybody who will listen, and has been very adamant that it's going to be, you know, those 2 games a year, scheduled not 10, 15 years in advance, but right before the season, so you have the best possible matchups. And don't get me wrong, I think it's a great idea. I do like it. But I feel like the ACC and the Pac-12 need it way more than the Big Ten does. If I'm the Big Ten, you know, forget this like spite toward Greg Sankey and whatnot. You're the Big Ten. You make as much money, if not more, than the SEC. You're not, the OU Texas thing is not a threat to you in any way. Play them. I want more Penn State Auburn. I don't want more Penn State Virginia or Penn State Utah or whatever, you know, games they're going to slate as part of this thing.
I agree. It was like, it just felt like a big game. Now, look, you're going to get some of those matchups that we're not going to care about. You're not going to care about Northwestern Vandy, for instance. I mean, you're going to care about it, but no one else is. You know, like, there are, it's big on big that we care about it. Big stadium, big venue, you know, just bigger rankings.
And, I think, and you can get big on big in the alliance when it's Ohio, if it's going to be Ohio State playing Oregon or Clemson, or I don't know if Florida State ever figures itself out.
We'll get to that
USC,
in a second.
Right. But the difference with the SEC is there's 9 or 10 teams that you could put on the schedule, and the Penn State fans or the Ohio State fans, or frankly any Big Ten fans, are going to be like, that's a big game. We want to prove ourselves against Auburn, against Arkansas, against Ole Miss, and certainly Alabama, LSU, Florida. So I'm not saying you should necessarily, Kevin Warren, get out of your non-contract with those other two conferences necessarily, but I feel like they might be boxing themselves in and frankly settling a little bit. I know that you can't extrapolate too much from one season, but the ACC and the Pac-12 have been terrible this year. With one exception, obviously. Oregon over Ohio State may be the best non-conference victory anybody has all season. But just yesterday we watched Colorado lose 30-0 to Minnesota. We watched Utah lose to San Diego State. We watched Arizona, poor Arizona, they're so bad, lose to Northern Arizona. And then the toughest one for the Pac-12, you know, you're already kind of looking at only 2 teams, Oregon and UCLA, to carry the banner for you. And UCLA loses a thriller to Fresno State behind one of the all-time great quarterback performances from Jake Haener at Fresno State. So Pac-12 is down to 1 undefeated team, and the ACC is down to 2, and those 2 are Wake Forest and BC.
Yeah, that's pretty. That sounds pretty bleak. Now look, undefeats are going to fall, you know, keep falling and everything like that. Shout out to Jake Haener. I mean, if you didn't get the chance to see the game because you don't have Pac-12 Network, pretty much everybody. But Like, I've never seen a player look so in agony as he did. The one touchdown pass he threw, I was like, that had to be a late hit because nobody was near him when he released the ball. And then you realize the play before, he got really hit by two guys, and Ali Kaho kind of drilled him in the ribs, or like, you know, it looked like he was wincing from that the rest of the game in total agony. And I thought our friend Yogi Roth, I thought, did a very good job of telling Jake Haner's story and working it into the broadcast. And you really, you know, he's an interesting kid. Like, the mom's like a big, she's like, I think she's a local TV news person, right, in the Bay Area, and pretty famous. And he was the guy who started out at Washington. I thought he was going to win the job. And obviously, when you have a five-star come home like Jacob Eason ends up getting the job. And he decides, hey, I'm going to go to Fresno. I just want to play. I'm not going to wait this thing out. And they're really good on offense. I mean, we've talked a decent amount about Fresno. I feel like, you know, for the first couple of weeks of the season, they have really good skill guys. You know, they're good. And it was fun to see a guy. I think, you know, you'd see it on social media. People were seeing how not only was he throwing for almost 500 yards, it was how he was doing it. Because, you know, like, DTR actually played pretty well beyond him losing the ball in the second quarter when he's trying to throw. But in the second half, he was pretty sharp. It was Jake Haner's night. It was very cool to see a guy like that. You know, like, those are stories we should be celebrating.
It's I would caution people, and we've spent all this time talking about this team looks bad and this team looks bad, and, you know, teams do get better over the course of the season. Some get worse. But also, just mathematically, some of these teams that you're so panicked about are going to go 10-2 anyway. And maybe I'm not, like, I didn't watch the UCLA Fresno State game and go, okay, UCLA, yeah, we were wrong about them. Fresno State's pretty good. They also gave Oregon a scare, if you recall. And they, you know, I think UCLA, based on what I'm seeing of the Pac-12, probably still one of the two best teams in the conference. That being said, all of this chaos, all of this vulnerability, you know what team stands to benefit from that possibly the most, Bruce? The Cincinnati Bearcats. Their road to a playoff berth was always going to be contingent on about 8 different dominoes. And one of them was knowing how the committee kind of frowns on the group of 5. They need some of these power conferences to have 2 lost champions, right? You don't want to have to, if you're undefeated Cincinnati, you don't want to be getting compared to a bunch of 12-1 Power 5 champs. Of course, you also have to go undefeated. And they took the first big step toward that Saturday. You know, we've been talking for 8 months about how they play both Indiana and Notre Dame in a 3-week period. They were dominated in the first half. Things were not looking good for Cincinnati in the first half. They were down 14-0, but it felt like 28-0. Because Indiana had a couple red zone trips where they didn't score. And then Micah McFadden, their great All-American linebacker, got ejected for targeting. And it was just
on
like...
On a third down play, Cincinnati is punting.
Yeah.
And Indiana's going to get the ball probably in very good field position with a chance to go up 17, if not 21-0. Instead, not only does he get thrown out of the game... So Cincinnati gets a first down, and now they're driving. They go down to score, and before you know it, it's 14-10 at halftime, right, as opposed to could have been, you know, 17-21 on the road. Here's what I wanted to ask you on that. So, and by the way, we haven't mentioned them yet. Notre Dame has not looked good at all. Like, I mean, they scuffled with Florida State. We know Florida State is so bad. We're going to talk about them in like 5 minutes. They had their hands full with a Toledo team that's not very good, and they didn't look very good against Purdue. But they're still undefeated.
They are a very hollow 3-0, but they are 3-0.
But here's the problem if I was a Cincinnati fan, and I hate it because I feel like we're moving the goalposts, but that's how this stuff works with the CFP. Indiana is now 1-2, and the one win is against Idaho. They got to go to, I mean, let's say they get by Western Kentucky on the road. They got to go to Penn State. Yeah, good luck on that trip. Michigan State now looks better. Then they have after those two games, and they got Ohio State right after them. Then they have road games to Maryland and Michigan. You know, it's like it would not surprise me if Indiana ended up 5-7 or 4-8 at this point. And that's not going to help Cincinnati at all.
Yeah, well, like I said, there are all these dominoes that need to fall into place. And one of them was they needed, you know, first of all, you have to beat these teams. And then you need at least one of Cincinnati or Notre Dame to be a top 25 team at the end of the season.
No, you need more than that, Stu. You need one of them to be like a top 15 and the other to be a top 25 season. You can't afford Notre Dame to be 19 and Indiana to be 5-7 or 4-8.
Ideally, yes, but that already seems out of the picture to me. I mean, IU, the biggest difference for IU from last season is Michael Penix is not the same quarterback. And this was his third knee injury. He's played, you know, two teams with a pulse, Iowa and Cincinnati, and thrown three interceptions against both of them. Two of those were pick sixes against Iowa. In this game, all three of those interceptions were, you know, all three of them were like, why are you throwing that? Don't do that. And I feel like he probably can't run like he used to and doesn't feel confident taking off and running when there's pressure. And so he's just forcing these awful throws. And Cincinnati turned those into points. Credit to Cincinnati's defense. We knew they were very good. They took advantage against Indiana. Like, my opinion of Cincinnati hasn't changed at all. I still think they're very good. But like you said, the resume might be not going to work out necessarily for them. The good news is they're starting so high.
But we saw them get glass ceiling last year, and that was in a pandemic year.
I don't even remember where they started. I can't remember if they were ranked at the start. No group of five teams since they started the playoff has started the season in the top 10 of the AP poll. So that by the time you get to those first committee rankings, if they're still undefeated just by inertia, they're going to be top 4 or 5 in the AP poll. As the committee, how much is the committee really going to?
I wouldn't have a ton of faith in the committee. They could have them 7. The problem is going to be other teams are going to have wins, and they're going to be, you know, a 7-1 or even a 6-2 that may end up being right next to them. And then you're starting to play. Like, it doesn't help them that UCF has already lost. And by the way,
lost Dylan Gabriel.
Dylan Gabriel for, you know, a month, who knows how long. Navy has been horrible. Temple is horrible. It didn't help them that, like, you know, they had a couple of things that happened. Like Tulane, it would have really been great for them if Tulane could have been competitive with Ole Miss. They weren't. UCF is terrible.
Bruce, they did catch two breaks.
A Hail Mary?
Yeah, it could have been complete disaster for their resume yesterday. SMU, November 20th, who's one of the better teams in that conference, needed a Hail Mary to survive Louisiana Tech, but they got the Hail Mary. And then in one of the crazier games of the day, Memphis beats Mississippi State, which is a good win. And they don't play Memphis in the regular season, but maybe they could in the conference championship. And I'm not sure, you know, I feel like once or twice a year you see just an absolutely egregious officiating error. It doesn't get much worse than this. Fourth quarter, close game, Mississippi State punts. It sure looks like two of their guys downed the ball. You see the ref make a signal. And then a Memphis player comes running over, picks it up, and runs 94 yards the other way, and it counts. And it's a touchdown.
And then like a half hour, ESPN shows footage where there's actually two number fours on the team for Memphis. So it shouldn't have counted anyway. They should have been penalized. When I'm watching them show the beginning of this highlight, I'm like, man, the guy who was rushing the punter, like, was that far down on one side of the field, and then he must have sprinted 75 yards, scooped up the ball, and run the other way. Only, no, there was two guys wearing number four, and I'm just thinking, when Leach sees this, it's going to blow his mind how bad he got effed, and I won't use his word for it, but just, like...
The SEC, man, to its credit, does not wait till Monday to put out the "we screwed up" statement. It was on Twitter within, like, 2 hours, but... Okay, I learned something. I thought that as soon as somebody on the other team just touches the ball, that's the end. But no, you have to like have possession of it, and nobody has a chance to return it before they actually are supposed to rule it dead. Now, this official did the stop the clock signal, so it should have been over right there. And then the two number fours should have invalidated the whole thing. So that's how Memphis prevailed. And because of that, you know, I mean, Cincinnati has everything to go right that can go right. And those two teams didn't suffer a non-conference loss. So that went for them.
Speaking of bad calls, I have a pet peeve on this. So something, and I'm trying to remember if it was, I think it was in Oklahoma State, Boise State. And this situation had come up earlier in the day in another game I was watching where there is a fumble. It doesn't look like it should stand. The player scoops it up and runs. They let the guy score or go downfield, and then they review it. In the case of the Boise State game, there is a play that you kind of watch and going, that looks like it's a fumble. The Boise State player picked it up, ran it in, and the referees basically blew it dead there. And then they reviewed the call, and they got it wrong. And so instead of having a touchdown, they just get the ball, I want to say, at like the 40. And it's like, you know, because I'm sitting there yesterday, I was in the, like I did a TV hit during the USC Washington State game to talk about the USC coaching search. And while I'm in there, I'm basically using Mike Pereira's spot, and I'm using his like pack. So, you know, but Blandino's in there with me, and we were kind of talking about like, you know, what is supposed to happen when that, and man, the refs, I think, really cost them a touchdown at that point, because you're supposed to let it play out if it's borderline. And that was definitely borderline.
We haven't even talked about the fact that Penn State, that they took a down away from them. That was also an SEC officiating crew, that they ended up punting on third down because nobody in the stadium seemed to realize that they had lost second down. Last thing I want to bring up, because you brought it up when we were talking last night, Miami, it's not looking good for Manny Diaz. I would not be surprised if there's a coaching change coming that way. What I was just floored by is when you said, you know, so Florida State, they're 0-3, they lost to an FCS team, and they got blown out by Wake Forest. You said, I think they may have a coaching change coming. I was like, are you kidding me? You think Florida State would fire a coach after two seasons yet again? Like,
they fired a coach, you know, not after two seasons with Willie Taggart.
Didn't they fire him with right? like four so, games left in his second season?
I mean, it's crazy.
At some point, you've got to give the coach a chance. Even if it's as bad as it looks, you can't keep changing coaches every 2 years and expect to ever get out of this cycle.
Here's the thing, like, and I like Mike Norvell. I thought he would do better than he's doing. He had a rough year last year. But they are 0-3. They were competitive. They took a ton of transfers, which you'd hope they would have gotten better. Fine. You lose to Notre Dame. They were competitive. It was a fun atmosphere. All that's, you know, fine. The next week you have the worst loss FSU has had in, I can't remember when, you know, they lost to Jacksonville State the way they lost. You know, you can say whatever you want about Willie Taggart. Willie Taggart didn't have any losses like that. And then they got blown out yesterday by Wake Forest. I mean, it wasn't even close. I mean, they're 0-3. You know, like, if you have fired Willie Taggart after a year and a half, like, I think all bets are off there in terms of like, oh yeah, we're going to make sure, because again, you know, Mike Norvell, we were coming out of a pandemic. That was a crazy year to have a first year at a program. But man, I wouldn't say that, oh, it's a sure thing that Mike Norvell is going to get another year now, not after the last couple of weeks. I mean, I just think that, you know, Florida State could go anywhere.
Florida State have an endless reserve of buyout money. Didn't they have to pay Willie Taggart over $20 million?
Yeah, I mean, and they did it. And quite honestly, it's like, after that, I just don't know. All of a sudden, you start to feel like Auburn, except you don't have as much of the, you know, you aren't as good as them.
I'm not giving up on Mike Norvell yet. Yeah, it's off to a bleak start this season. But I do think that they...
Look, I'm not giving up on him either. We were talking about on my car ride home from the studio last night. Like, I don't think... nothing would surprise me with Florida State now after the last 2 weeks. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, the thing people need to realize is with the early signing period now, when your coach gets hired, you know, that class is a lost cause. It used to be you could come in and, You know, I remember when Urban Meyer got the Ohio State job, he came in and in the month of January, he got like a bunch, Taylor Decker, Noah Spence, just off the top of my head, like a bunch. He got a bunch of big time guys to flip to Ohio State. Now, most of those guys are already signed. So Mike Norvell only now signed his first real recruiting class. And yeah, you just can't start over again yet.
But you also, Stu, now you have the transfer portal. You didn't have that a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but you can't. That can't be the lifeblood of your program.
I'm not saying it isn't, but you can. It is hard. I think I hear what you're saying, but you have the transfer portal now. I'm not saying that people should fire coaches after a year or two, but you can get a lot more experienced players. It's less of a development deal than before, and I think that is one of the things that is going to get. You know, I think like you can't really say, okay, well, because you lose a class. I mean, they signed a ton of transfers with this group.
I do think Manny Diaz, I think you would agree, is in real trouble. He's just had so many just, you know, games there where they just get so embarrassed. You know, I think of that bowl game against Louisiana Tech. I think of that UNC game last year. Miami, you know, Alabama, obviously, they get blown off the field. And then, you know, not in a good look to get blown out of home by Michigan State. And so if that happens, you can already see what we're heading toward, and that is the Miami.
You're going to piss off the people in Eugene, Oregon right
now. Yes, the Miami USC bidding war over Mario Cristobal. Nobody is more Miami than Mario Cristobal. His, you know, at the Oregon game, he invited his high school coach from Miami from 30 years ago. He was in the front row. The guy, you know, went to the U, was the coach of FIU. He's Miami through and through. But if you're at Oregon and you have developed that program into a program that we think has a chance to make playoff appearances and you know, 2022 people are pointing to there as like they could have a national championship caliber team, are you going to give that up to go to a school that can't pay you as much as Oregon and is just a, you know, massive rebuilding job waiting to happen?
I don't know, honestly. I know that in my mind, just knowing Mario, and I went to school with him, so I've known him for a long time. USC can pay Mario a lot more than Miami can, but Miami is home, as you said, all those things. Miami, you know, his brother Lou is a Miami-Dade police officer. Family is entrenched there. I mean, he is so part of that culture. I was with him because we were doing their bowl game when they played Michigan State, basically when the Miami job came open and when Miami scrambled to turn around and bring Manny Diaz back to become the head coach. They couldn't have afforded Mario's buyout at that point, which was somewhere between $11 and $12 million. I'm not sure Miami could afford Mario's buyout now at $9 million. So it may be a non-starter even at that point. The only thing that I do wonder about, because everything you said, I agree with. Like, I know Mario thinks he's got a really good team now, and I think deep down he thinks they're going to be even better in 2022 and in 2023. The flip side of this is, this may be the last realistic time that, the, you know, if he wants to be the head coach at Miami, and if it gets to that point, they haven't fired Manny Diaz. They're still... I suspect the rest of the season, if they can turn it. But if it's on his radar, I'm not sure, you know, like I said, they're going to be really good. And, you know, he thinks they're going to be really good in 2022, 2023. I don't think Mario Cristobal is anything like, you know, would Ryan Day become an NFL head coach before too long? It wouldn't shock me if Ryan Day became an NFL head coach. It wouldn't shock me if Lincoln Riley became an NFL head coach. I'd be very surprised if Mario Cristobal became an NFL head coach. I think the two jobs most likely that would give him like a thought would be the one job that is open at USC and the other job where now the head coach is really on the hot seat. And I have no idea. I'm not even sure if Mario has a sense of what he really thinks would be best for him. But if he ever wants to be the Miami head coach, you know, it's going to be a rebuilding job. I mean, no matter what, you know, it's like you're not going to get elevated there, right? It's after a team that played for a national title. It's just not how it works.
You say this might be the only chance at the rate, you know, at the last 20 years of Miami football, I think you can just wait 4 years and there'll be another opening. It's pretty wild when you think about, you know, when we were growing up or when you were even in school there, that Miami, you know, Howard Schnellenberger brings the program to prominence. He leaves. Jimmy Johnson comes in. They don't miss a beat. He leaves. Dennis Erickson comes in. They don't miss a beat. Then they have the sanctions, but Butch Davis was, you know, gets them back to where they are. And ever since Larry Coker got fired, they cannot figure out the right formula. And they've tried everything. They've tried Randy Shannon was the, you know, the great defensive coordinator, great former player there. He can't get it done. Al Golden, I don't remember who else was in the mix, but he was, you know, the hot mid-major coach, if you will, at Temple. He didn't work out. Mark Richt was a SEC, you know, SEC championship accomplished head coach. He didn't work out. And Manny Diaz, you know, we just talked about Cristobal and all his Miami ties. Manny Diaz is literally the son of the former mayor of Miami, and it's not going so well. So I don't. What's the magic answer here? Like what do you need to be?
I think each of those guys struggled for a different reason. Larry Coker, you know, who did win a national title and started out 34-0, or I think, I don't know if he started out 34-0, but he started out probably like 22-0 or something like that. I think his issue was ultimately lack of accountability. You know, there was an edge in the program before he took over. He had great leadership in the locker room. Eventually that kind of petered out. Randy Shannon could not find the answer to have a good offensive coordinator. I think that, you know, Patrick Nix, Bo's dad, might have been like the 10th choice he had. And I just feel like it was sideways from there. Al Golden was, you know, he recruited it like he was still at a mid-major program. He lost the ties to South Florida. Mark Richt, offense similar to Randy Shannon, did not have a great feel for the offense.
Mark Richt hires his son as the quarterback coach was the big problem there.
Now, Mark Richt does deserve credit, I think, for this. He infused a bunch of money and raised a lot of money to upgrade facilities, which was much needed, and I think that was important. Where Manny Diaz, I think, from talking to people who've been, you know, close to the program, have said is, are they physical enough in how they practice and some of those other things? And I think he's made a lot of good moves, but right now where they are struggling is on his side of the ball. They are not tackling well, and they do not look very physical. Offensive line has been awful at Miami for a long time. I felt like it's gotten a little better, but that's hard to get way better like overnight or in a year. And I think at some point there's just so much pressure on De'Arik King, who is like, you want to talk a little bit about Jake Haener. I mean, he looks like he's being held together in some of these games by, like, you know, like glue and scotch tape. And it's just a lot right now. I mean, I thought the one game they won, they didn't look very good in that game either. Nope. Against App State. And App State's a good mid-major program, but still, if you're Miami, you got to be a little more dominant in that. And, you know, again, they've had three games. They're all non-conference games. It's not like the ACC is very good. You know, it's possible they can get some momentum and start to grow from here. They got to get better on defense, though. And I think what's the tricky position for Manny Diaz is that is a fan base that will turn quick if they feel like it's not going in the right direction. And
oh, I think they've already turned.
Yeah, and look, I think that in a lot of ways, you look at it and you're like, man, this is, I think he's made some really good moves, but at the end of the day, you know, even the first hire he made, one of the first big hires he made was Dan Enos. That was a disastrous hire. Like you talked about that Louisiana Tech bowl game. They were horrible in that coming, you know, like the offense was such a mess. I thought Rhett Lashley was a good hire for him. But right now, they just feel like they are really struggling to get a lot of stuff sorted out, and they've been really sloppy.
I think that, and we talked about this really last night, somebody in the either this year or next is going to hire Bill O'Brien as their head coach. Like, that seems like a foregone conclusion to me, both because the last two Alabama OCs have gotten Power 5 head coaching jobs, and because Bill O'Brien was a pretty good NFL head coach. He took over Penn State in the worst possible circumstances and kept them respectable. Why not Miami?
I don't know about Miami. I thought you were going to say, here's what I would wonder about more than that. You know, look, Miami's a pro town. I just don't know. The thing you wonder about, and yes, he got Christian Hackenberg, and he got Christian Hackenberg's dad to buy in. The thing you wonder about is, how good of a recruiter will he be? And, you know, whether, you know, like we talk about this with USC, we talk about it, you know, like you have to be somebody who can really recruit your ass off as a head coach. I'm sorry. And like one of the things that, and again, I'm not saying Bill O'Brien can't do this, but guys who come from the NFL, that's the biggest difference piece of this is the recruiting aspect of it. And if you're not going to be a guy who is busting your ass recruiting and is really, really on top of things, you're going to underachieve. I mean, because you are going to go into a lot of dogfights in recruiting. And I think that's going to be a challenge. Now, look, one thing, and I did our Big Noon Kickoff show yesterday morning, and I talked about the USC job. And I have an NFL scout I know who texted me right after, because I had mentioned James Franklin as one of the guys I think is a prime candidate for USC. And this person was like, do you think Penn State would take Bill O'Brien back? And I don't know the answer to that, because, you know, if Penn State comes open, I think immediately you look at maybe Matt Campbell and or Luke Fickell. But at the same time, you know, and who knows how hot Oregon stays, and then maybe Joe Moorhead looks like an option. I don't know. But, you know, the Bill O'Brien one was interesting when this guy said it, just because there were a lot of old guard Penn State people who really had a lot of respect for what Bill O'Brien did there. So I don't know if the fan base would want him back. I don't know if he would want to be back. And the job's certainly not open, but I just was like, whoa, you know, that was something I hadn't
really considered. Nobody is trying to get giving James Franklin the USC job more than you are, Bruce. I watched your TV hit during the game. It was all about James Franklin.
Where am I wrong, though? Who do you think is a better option?
Well, here's the thing. I've agreed with you. I to this point, I've said, we've watched over the last few years, James Franklin has struggled to totally win over that fan base. He's been very criticized at times. And so my thing was, you know, people would be like, there's no way you would leave Penn State. He's a Pennsylvania native. Well, you kind of think like he might. And if he's going to leave, USC would be a pretty good spot for him. That being said, you watch that scene last night. They get the big win. If Penn State goes on to win the Big Ten this year, then I don't think he's leaving. Then I think he's getting a huge contract extension. He's got a number one, well, probably won't finish number one, but right, number one type recruiting class coming in. You know, all of a sudden, we're all rah-rah James Franklin at Penn State. So if you're USC and you really want James Franklin, your best scenario would be for them to go like 9-3.
I don't know the answer to that. You know, like, I don't think him getting a huge contract extension at Penn State is going, like, I don't think that will be the oh, I'm not going to go to USC or not. I think it's like after 7 years, like he's got at this point, the money I don't think is the issue. I think some of it was like, you know, some of the commitment to facilities and some of the other things in terms of the resources of the program, which I've heard they've upgraded, you know, in recent years. I ultimately think the question is, where do you want to be? Where do you want to raise your family? And where do you think has the bigger upside?
Boy, Penn State fans are going to – you are not their friend right
now. No, let's be honest. No, let's be honest.
That's funny, though. I mostly agree with you. I saw somebody in my Twitter –
Who is the Ohio State in the Pac-12 South?
You don't have to sell me on why it's a good job. It's a good job for him. I think
– No, I'm not saying why it's a good job. Like, why if it's like – what is a job that you have a better chance to win a national title at?
That's realistically going to come open, that one. And also, I remember him at Vanderbilt and how he won over the city of Nashville at a school that never could. And I think he would fit in well in L.A. But again, my thing is, if Penn State goes on and they lose to Ohio State again and maybe one other game and they're going to the Outback Bowl and USC wants him, I'm on the plane. But if this turns out to be a really great season, a Big Ten title season, maybe even a playoff season, he's not going to leave at that point. That would be Who leaves the reigning Big Ten champion to go to another school?
I think if it's a playoff, it is harder. Yeah. If it's a Big Ten champion and he is...
And playing in the Rose Bowl. Big Ten champion playing in the Rose Bowl.
11-2. I don't know. I don't know. That is an interesting dynamic. So tell me, if not James Franklin, who do you think should be the head coach? You haven't really said this.
I haven't said it because I don't have the answer. I don't know that there's an option. I mean,
well, you can't say like, well, you keep pushing this, and it's like.
I think James Franklin is the.
Let's not talk about James Franklin.
I think he's the best candidate for the job. I'm just saying maybe he won't necessarily leave for the job, and at that point,
you might be
there's
right.
not okay, an obvious. Yeah, that guy should definitely be the USC coach.
Dante Williams
is off to a great start. What if he ends up winning the job?
We've seen this movie before. It doesn't play well for USC. It doesn't.
We've got time to sort that out. We got 2 months to figure out who the head coach of the USC job is. I think we should probably wrap this episode of the Audible. Are you already late for your son's football game?
Not far from it. Okay. Yeah.
So. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com, and we answer them on our Wednesday episode. We'll see you next time.